Okay, it's 11:10. Let's get started. Are there any questions? Yes. Okay, so the question is, if you try to access the website for past papers, which is maintained by the university, from outside the university network, it says access forbidden. The solution to that is, of course, to access it from within the university network. The university has decided not to just let everybody in the world see the past papers here. That's the reason why access is forbidden. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so you remember that last time we were learning about algebraic data types and constructors, and we were just getting to the point where I was going to teach you how to get a computer to do your first homework assignment for computation and logic. Building truth tables. One person mentioned that they weren't really very motivated by that because, of course, they've already done the homework assignment. But if you looked at this week's tutorial, you'll know that this week's tutorial is to write a program that could do your computation and logic tutorial for you by doing truth tables. So you should be motivated because it's this week's tutorial. So what I'm going to do is show you the basic technique, and then the tutorial involved you extending that technique to deal with a few more logical connectives. Now, last time I made a meal of two different things. I want to check if people want me to review this or if I straightened it out sufficiently. The first thing is, because constructors and functions look so similar, I think it might be rather easy to confuse them. I gave you these fairly confusing rules about where you could use a function name and where you could use a constructor name. Would you like me to spend a little bit of time reviewing that at the beginning?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So my apology for making a meal out of it. Your inconvenience means that next year I will do a better job, but let me try to sort it out. So it's really very easy, right? So to show how easy it is, I will jump up and down a couple of times. All you need to do is keep track of two different things, functions and constructors. They look really similar, right? We've made them look similar for a reason, but they are different. So all you need to do is keep track of functions on the one hand and constructors on the other hand. And, right, special benefit, it's easy to tell them apart because functions always begin with a small letter, and constructors always begin with a capital letter. That's why we have that constraint, just to make things easy. So, right, what's the difference? We need the magic piece of chalk. No magic piece of chalk. Sad. A whole box of chalk. Oh, I can do anything now. So, here's our favorite function definition. What was it? F of x and y is equal to, what is it? What was it? I can't remember now. X times x plus y, wasn't it? There's a typical example for you. So f is a function name, right? X and y are formal parameters, and this is the body of the function definition. And of course, the scope of x and y is this body. Everybody's familiar with that idea, right? So we're on familiar ground so far? So now let's look at another simple function definition. Let's say take, we can vote. Which one do you want to see? Do you want to see take or zip or append? How many people want take? Okay. Zip. Well, lots of people like zip. Append. Well, everybody's in a zip mood this morning. Okay, so we will do zip. So zip. Now, there were three different equations for zip, right? We worried about, because there are two arguments, and we worry about, we'll use algebraic notation, is if we're defining our own list type. Right. So the first possibility is the first list is empty. The second possibility is the first list is non-empty. And the second list is empty. And the third possibility and now I've run out of room. No, I haven't. Okay, so zip of the empty list and any other list is the empty list. Zip of a non-empty list with the empty list is the empty list. Zip of a list, a non-empty list with a non-empty list, what do we do? Okay, I'm going to pick that person there, wearing the blue shirt at the end of the row. Yes? So just speak up a little bit. Pair of x and y is the head of the list, right? So what's the very first thing I'm going to write down? Cons, excellent. I'm going to return a list. And then, yes, let's use, you said pair, good idea. So we'll be these algebraic types again. Pair of x and y. Good. And what do I do for the tail? Perfect. And recursively, we zip x's and y's together. Okay, so they should look familiar, except I've written cons and pair and nil, all using the notation from algebraic types that I showed you yesterday, right, which is right here. Right, so here's our definition of list in terms of nil and cons. Here's our definition of pair in terms of pair. Okay, so this is a constructor of the pair type. This, the pair type of whatever x and y are, say it's a and b. So the type of this will be pair. If x has type a and y has type b, this will have type pair ab. And then this will be a list of pairs of a's and b's. The typing. So write this up here. So it takes a list of A and a list of B and returns a list of pair of A and B. And now we can go through and say, okay, what is the function being defined here? It's zip. It begins with a small letter, it's a function. It has two arguments in each equation. The first time, this argument is a formal parameter, but this argument is a constructor, nil. Here, this is the first argument. So with the constructor cons, this is a nil. Here, I've written x and x's. These are, again, formal parameters. Here, we've got two parameters again. The first one's a cons, the second one is a cons. The general rule is your first thing is always a function. These following things are called patterns. And what is a pattern? A pattern is always either a constructor name applied to zero or more patterns, or it's a variable. So here we have a constructor applied to zero patterns. Here we have a constructor applied to two patterns. Each of these is itself a variable. In general, I could do a cons of x and cons of y and z, say, or something like that. That would also be a pattern. Does anybody need to see that written out? But what I couldn't do is have a function name here applied to two things. Right? You might think, hey, it's actually quite reasonable. Wouldn't it be cool if I could define unzip this way? So unzip is going to take a zipped list and return the two components. And I say unzip of zip of x's and y's is the pair of x's and y's. Wouldn't that be neat? But poor computer gets upset here. It doesn't know how to, if you gave it a list of pairs, it would know how to bind x's and y's, such that zipping them together gave this list. So it can't match against this. Constructors, there's always a unique way of taking them apart. That's why you're allowed to put constructors further down, but not a function name. So if I wanted to actually do an unzip like this, what would I do? I would say unzip xy's. This is a list of xy pairs. Would be pair of map first and map second. Where? Well, in fact, I don't need to say anywhere because first and second are predefined. I'll show you what the definitions look like. The first of a pair of x and y is x, and the second of a pair of x and y is y. Okay, so this definition doesn't work because it violates the rule that you can only have constructors nested inside a left-hand side. The only function must appear right at the outside. This obeys the rule, right? We've got a pattern here, it's just a variable name. And we form the pair of extracting the list of all the first components and the list of all the second components. And then the definition of first, we do have a constructor in here, but that's fine, this is a constructor, and here we have a constructor. I'll just move that up a bit. Good point. Don't do this. Do that. It's a good suggestion. There's a rule that says never write down something that you're not allowed to do without making it very clear that you're not allowed to do it. So, yes, I should put a cross next to it. Okay. Did that help? At least some people nodding. Good. Okay. Are you ready to learn how to do truth tables? Yes. Okay. So, a proposition is either going to be just the name of some variable, right? These are sometimes called atomic propositions. Is that what you call them in computation and logic? Yes? Or it's F. Why didn't I write false here? False is already defined, so I'm not allowed to use it. You can only define constructor names once. So I made up another name to mean false, F. Similarly for T. Or not of a proposition. Notice not is capitalized, so that's the constructor, or proposition, or proposition and proposition. Does anybody remember why I've written a colon here rather than just writing a vertical bar? Right, because just as function names start with a small letter and constructor names start with a capital letter, our functions might be infix operators or our constructors might be infix operators. If it's an operator, the equivalent of beginning with a capital letter is beginning with a colon. And you can remember that silly rule because cons is itself a constructor and it's written with a colon. So it obeys the rule. So proposition or proposition, proposition and proposition. Oh, and here I've put in this little thing. Remember how before, right, I was always telling you, here's how you do equality for shapes, or here's how you do equality for seasons, and so on. I wrote out those definitions at great length. So I could do that here, but instead I'm making use of something which I will explain more next week, which is that Haskell has built into it ways of knowing how to define equality and also ordering on things and also how to show things. So if you say deriving EQ, it derives the function written as two equal signs. Ord derives less than, greater than, and so on. And if you say show with a capital S, it derives the show function. Being a function, of course, that begins with a small s. So here, I'm not quite sure why I put ord in there, but we will make use of eek, I think. And then I'm going to need one other thing, which is an environment, which is when you have a truth table, right? When you're working out the truth table for a formula, what you try to do is work out for each of the atomic propositions, what happens if it's true, what happens if it's false. So I'll need a way of knowing for each name whether it corresponds to true or false, and that's what the environment gives me. So the environment represents, for each name that I'm interested in, whether it's true or false. I'm going to give that as a list of pairs. This is actually a finite function, right? An infinite function is something like square. You can give it an infinite number of integers. So if I tried to write it out as a list, it would be a very long list. But finite functions, we can actually write them out as a list of pairs. Of course, in mathematics, you often are taught when you learn set theory that a function is represented, right, as an infinite set of pairs, right? So for the square function, it would include the pair 1, 1, and the pair 2, 4, and the pair 3, 9, and so on. And since there are an infinite number of integers, there'd be an infinite number of such pairs. We can sort of do that in Haskell, but for infinite things, we tend to give a rule for computing the function instead, right? We say the square of x is x times x. But for finite functions, this often works very well. So a finite function can be represented as a list of the argument and its corresponding value. Now, I could have said deriving show, but if I did so, then of course it would print things out as f and t and not, and then whatever that print says, and this thing, and colon, bar colon, and so on. It makes it look exactly like this. I didn't quite want to do that, so I'll define show on my own. Right, so how do we show a proposition? Well, if it's var x, luckily for us, names are strings, so if I return the name, that is a string. To show f, I return the string f. To show t, I return the string t. To show not p, I prepend a tilde, which is the symbol I'm using for negation, to the result of showing p. And then to show colon, bar colon, to show or, I'll just use a single or symbol when showing it without the colons to make it a little bit simpler. And remember that par just wraps open and close brackets around something. So I think we've got an example. We will in a minute. Right. So if P0 is this, var A and var B, or not var A and not var B, and I say show of that, it would print it out this way. Is that clear enough? Okay. Now the next thing we need to do, oh, and notice that because of par is in there, right? When it prints it out, all the parts are surrounded by parentheses. Ooh, ooh, I got that wrong, right? What will it really print out? Right, there'll be parentheses around the whole thing as well. That's a typo. Who's gonna send typos to me? You'll send typos to me? Thank you. So typo, there should be extra parentheses. Now the next thing we're going to need to do to calculate the truth table, right, is let's say our formula was A and B, or not A and not B. When I make a truth table there, how many rows am I going to need in the truth table? Sorry? Four. And why is it four? So I've got two variables, A and B. Each of them has two possibilities. 2 times 2 is 4. If I had three variables, how many rows would I need?
Eight.
Because 2 times 2 times 2 is 8. So I need to know which variables I have in the formula, right? I need to know in this case that the variables I'm interested in are A and B. So I need a function to extract the variables that appear in a formula. So the way we do that is with names, which is going to extract all the names that appear in the formula. So the names that appear in this formula, right, is just x. How many names appear in this formula? None. So I return the empty list. How many names appear in this formula? None. So I return the empty list. Which names are going to appear in the formula not p? All the names that appear in p. Not isn't a name, so that we don't need to worry about that. Whoops, what happened? Similarly, for P or Q, I fall in all the names that appear in P and all the names that appear in Q, and I append them together to make a big list. But the same name, right, if it was A and B or not A and not B, right, the names that appear in A and B are A and B, and the names that appear in Q, which would be not A and not B, would be A and B. So I get the list ABAB. I want to remove duplicates from it. There's a function in the standard prelude called nub that does just that. So nub, given a list, removes subsequent duplicates in the list. It retains only the first unique occurrence of each value. And so similarly, for names P and Q, I just take the names in P, the names in Q, append them together, and then use nub to remove duplicates. Okay, so is it clear how names works? Any questions about that? Please ask a question. Yes?
I don't know what var x means.
What does var x mean? Right, let's look at our example. For the formula A and B or not A and not B, I need some way of representing A. I can't just write A there because A is a string. And the type I'm defining here is prop. So what I did when I originally defined prop is I said one of the alternatives, right, there are prop is one of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different things. And one of those is var followed by a string. Is that?
Why couldn't
I just use a string? Well, because the rule is when you're defining a new type, you always have a constructor name followed by a bunch of arguments, right? If I just wrote name there, it would take name to be a constructor name, not to be the type string. Okay? This is in fact a very important limitation of Haskell, which is you can't just throw two types together willy-nilly. You have to throw them together by introducing suitable constructors. You'll remember that similarly, there was the sum type. This is your way of throwing two types together. You either have left in front of the first type or right in front of the second. I can't just say int bar string for something that's an int or a string, but I can say left int bar right string, And I'd have to write left in front of every integer and right in front of every string. Good question. Thank you. Yes? What happens if you give nub an infinite list? It will return an infinite list with any duplicates in that list removed. If you try to print the whole infinite list, you will get in trouble. No, because if say you've tried to represent the sine function as a list of pairs, that's a good idea. The angle, your argument to the function, there are an infinite number of different angles you could supply. And then the result, in fact, there are also an infinite number of different results, but they cycle. But if you applied nub, so if you took the infinite list of pairs for sine, now, you'd probably want to write that list in order of increasing numbers, right? Now you get in trouble because you're doing floating point numbers. There's no way of writing a floating point number and then the next one that comes after it, because you could be infinitely small. So trying to write it that way probably won't work too well. But good question. Did that help? Okay, so that's how we do names. And I think we've got an example of that as well. Right, so if I say the names in the formula P0, then it returns the two names A and B. Now, wait a minute, why didn't it say var A and var B? Well, if we go back to our definition of names, we said var X gives us just the list containing X. We dropped off the var. So we're just returning a list of strings, not a list of propositions. Okay? So that's why we get AB, and it would have been ABAB, except for nub, which removes the duplicates. Okay. And then the last thing we need to do is, given an environment, a mapping from names to their value, and given a proposition, return whether that proposition is true or false. So the tricky one is, if it's an atomic proposition, what we do, this thing here, E is the environment, the mapping of names to truth values, names to Booleans, is called the environment. I've written E for it, E for environment. People sometimes write R for environment. That's because in the when people first did this, they couldn't just stick with ordinary letters. So they wrote rho for the environment, and rho gets abbreviated to R, rho being a Greek letter. So E or R is usually used to be the environment. And then we've got each kind of proposition here. So a variable is the interesting one, and we just find that by looking up the variable in the environment. So in general, lookup takes a list of AB pairs and an A and returns a B. Notice that what this really does, via currying, right, this really takes just one argument, which is our list of AB pairs, and it returns a function that, given an A, returns a B. So, so lookup actually converts a list of AB pairs to a function from A to B, which is what we wanted. And notice that we can only do this if we can compare two elements A to see if they're equal. So that's why this eq A funny arrow gets written in the front. This is a Haskell type class. But this just means A can be any type as long as we know how to compare it for equality. In our case, it's string, and we do know how to compare strings to see if they're equal. And B can be any type at all. So what are we going to do? Yes?
If we want to look up to return a function, shouldn't we put parentheses around A to B?
Right, we could put parentheses here, and it means the same thing. If you remember how currying works, it always implicitly puts the parentheses there. Good question, though. So to do lookup, all we're going to do is we'll use a list comprehension, right? And we'll say, find the list of y's where x prime y is a pair that appears in the list x y's, and x is equal to x prime. So this will give us a list of the y values. There should be exactly one if we're looking something up properly. So I've defined this function the, V takes a list with exactly one thing in it and returns that one thing. So this finds the one thing in this list of pairs that has a matching x coordinate and returns the corresponding y coordinate. Yes?
We could have used the head function as well.
Could I have used head here instead of V? When the answer is correct, it would do the same thing. What would happen if I gave it a list that had A paired with true and also had A paired with false? What would it do then?
It would return just one of them.
Would just return one of them. Whereas the one that I've written here, instead of returning one of them, what does it do?
It returns both, but...
No, it doesn't return both. This returns a list with two things in it, and then V applied to that list does what? So what does V do if you give it a list of length 2? We'll take a vote. How many people think it returns the first element in the list of length 2? Nobody. How many people think it returns the second element? How many people think it picks one of the elements at random? How many people think it gives an error? Right, it gives an error. That's because, right, the stupid computer tries to match this equation, and it can't. Notice, by the way, this is an example, right? We hadn't seen any examples. No, we did, actually. No, we didn't. We hadn't seen any examples where we had more complicated patterns. But notice that if I wrote V out using the cons and nil notation, it would look like this. Right, this is how I would write a list of length 1 whose single element is x. So here's an example of a more interesting pattern. Right, so here's my function name, v. Here's my argument, which is a pattern. It begins with a constructor and is followed by two patterns. The first is the variable x. The second is itself a constructor, nil. So that's how V works. So lookup just finds, looks in your list that pairs names with truth values and returns the corresponding truth value. Yes?
Would there be a way in Haskell to define data type that would not accept an additional, that would not accept duplicates in the first position of its composing pairs?
Ooh, what a good question. Wouldn't it be convenient if, as well as defining the type that's a list of pairs, we could define the type that's a list of pairs that represents a function, so that you never have a pair with the same first component twice? Wouldn't that be handy? Yes, that's my current research program. How would you do that? It's still an open question what the best way of doing something like that is. There is an advanced feature in Haskell called contracts that lets you do that sort of thing. But would it work for that one? I think it won't work for that one, because in Haskell, you're only allowed to do it if the compiler proves that that constraint is always satisfied. And as you could imagine, right, trying to work out, for the compiler to work out, this is always going to return a list of pairs is easy. Trying to work out, this is always a list of pairs with no first component duplicated, that can be rather hard. So it would be great to support that, but Haskell doesn't support that yet. But I like the way you think. Okay, so that's how lookup works, right? To eval f, that's easy, just return false. To eval t, that's easy, just return true. To eval not p, well, that's actually very easy. Just evaluate p in the environment, that will give you true or false, and then just take the negation of it with the not function. Right, notice this is the not function, which is different from the not constructor. To eval E of P or Q, it's just the same. Evaluate P in the environment, evaluate Q in the environment, and then OR the results. The same for AND. So then here's an example, right? Let P0 be the proposition A and B, or not A and not B. Let E0 be the environment that says A is false and B is false. So then if we try to show this, right, we get A and B or not A and not B with extra parentheses around the outside. If we ask for the names in this, we get A and B are the two names that appear in this formula. And if we try to evaluate in environment 0 the proposition P0, then what will we do? Well, we will first try to evaluate, right, it's an OR, so it says we'll evaluate this and evaluate this, and that's going to evaluate this one. So it's an AND, so it says evaluate this and evaluate this, and that's a VAR, so to evaluate a VAR, we look it up in the environment, and A is false. So the evaluation of this proposition is false. The evaluation of this proposition is false. And when we AND the two together, we get false and false is false. Whoever said true might do okay in Haskell, but they'll do rotten in computation and logic. And then to do this one, it's very similar. To evaluate the AND formula, we first evaluate the first subformula, which is a NOT. To evaluate the NOT, we first evaluate its subformula, which is a VAR. VAR of A will, of course, evaluate. It'll look it up in here. It'll return false. NOT of false is true. Similarly, for this subformula, we look up B. It's false. NOT of false is true. So now we've got true and true, which is true. So this is false, this is true, and false or true is true. And indeed, if we do eval of E0 and P0, we get true. And this was just showing one part of it, right? If we look up A in E0, we get what A is matched with, which is false. Okay, clear enough? Now, to work out whether something, to work out the truth table for something, we need to work it out not just for one environment, but for all possible environments. So how can we work out all possible environments? So this is a trick that you will see again and again within Haskell, is it's very easy to form a list of all the possibilities using comprehensions and recursion. So for instance, to form a list of all the possible environments for a given list of names, so we're given a list of names and we want to return a list of environments. And if this list has two things in it, how many things will there be in the, how many different environments will we return? Four. If this list has three things in it, how many environments will we return?
Eight.
And if this has 10 things in it, how many environments will we return? 10,024. Very good. You know your powers of two. So 2 to the 10th is 10,024. So, no, 1,024. Sorry. And if this has zero things in it, how many environments do we return? One, not zero? Why is it one? Right? Because if this has length n, we return 2 to the n different environments, and 2 to the 0 is one. So we return one environment. Which environment is it? The empty environment. Right? Each environment will have a length corresponding to the length of names. Okay, so now, let's say our first name is X, and all the remaining names are X's. What are we going to do? Well, X, there are two possibilities, right? Either X is false or X is true. So we'll return one list of environments beginning with X false pairs and one beginning with X true pairs. And E will just be all the possible environments for the remaining list. So that's where we use recursion. So this just says, find all the environments for the remaining list and return that, and for each such environment, return the same environment with x false at the beginning, and also for each such one, return the same thing with x true at the beginning, and then just append those together. Let's see if this does the right thing. So we know it's supposed to be the case that if this has length n, this returns 2 to the n different things, each of length n. Let's check that that's right. So if this is 0, this returns 2 to the 0, one thing, each of those things is of length 0. That's OK. Let's try it here. X's has length n. X cons x's has length n plus 1. So n's of x's should be 2 to the n things, each of length n. So this will return 2 to the n things, each of length n plus 1, because we've added one thing to the beginning. And this returns 2 to the n things, each of length n plus 1, because we've added one to the beginning. And we append two lists of length 2 to the n together, and what do we get? A list of length 2 times 2 to the n, which is the same as 2 raised to the n plus 1. So this does have the correct length. Notice a different way of doing this, which is very similar, is instead of using two comprehensions and appending them together, I can use one comprehension with two generators. I can say return xb constant to e, where b is drawn from the list bs, where bs is just two possibilities, false and true. And then e is drawn from n vexes as before. Can people see why these two things return the same result? Remember the way we formally defined comprehensions, you'll remember that this was actually defined by appending a bunch of things together. So it would be this. Yes?
If we give it two elements and the two elements are the same, I mean, we would have duplicates. Shouldn't we use nub to remove them?
Ah, I'm assuming here that nub has already been applied to names. But if it hadn't been, if names was allowed to contain duplicates, then we probably would want to do what you described. So I'm assuming that the names list has no duplicates in it so that we get a sensible environment. Good point. So, right, ends of the empty list is the list containing the empty environment. Ends of B, right, would be the pair of B with false and of B with true, each constant to each thing returned by this, well, there's only one thing returned, the empty environment. Okay? And then ends of A and B, this is the interesting one, right? It would be A false constant to E, where E is all the environments for B, and A true constant to E, where E is all the environments for B. But all the environments for B is B paired with false, right? And B paired with true. So A false constant to all possible e's, well, we get a false constant to b false, and a false constant to b true, and similarly for the other one. And then we put that all together, and we get the four possibilities. Do people see how that works? Any questions about that? Okay, you should all know enough to play stupid computer and work that out in great detail if you needed to. So now, we know how to form the truth table for a formula. We just do eval EP for each E drawn from the environments of the names in P. And somebody pointed out, wait, we need to make sure that this has no duplicates, but names was defined using nub, so it won't have any duplicates, so that's okay. So then this forms eval E, this will be a list of eval EP for each possibility. And then the formula is satisfiable if true appears anywhere in that list, which we could work out by doing OR of the whole list. So a formula will be satisfiable exactly when we can evaluate it for each possible environment, and at least one of those returns true, which is what. So this will give us a list of trues and false, and then OR will return true if a true appears anywhere in that list. Yes?
Should it be satisfiable
So if it's a tautology, everything will be true, right? And or of a list consisting just of trues will return. There's actually one place where satisfiable and tautology differ. Can you work out what it is? Right, satisfiable says for every possible environment, sorry, for some possible environment it's true. Tautology says for every possible environment it's true. There's exactly one case where those would differ, which is if there's no possible environment. However, we know that there's always at least one environment, right, the empty environment. So in that case, right, for the empty list, right, working out if it contains a true or false wouldn't happen. But the length of this is always the length of something returned by environments, which is never empty. So in fact, satisfiable and tautology never differ. Sorry, tautology implies satisfiable, not conversely. So now, if I work out what are all the environments for this formula, right, it's all four possibilities. And if I evaluate P0 under each of those four possibilities, I get true, false, false, and true. And then if I ask, is this satisfiable? It says, well, does true appear in that list? Yes, so it's true. So that's it. And then for your homework, what you're going to do is add some kinds of propositions, like implication, to the evaluator, and extend your testability test to also work out things like, is it a tautology, and things like that. Okay? And also maybe I think there's an extended exercise which is printing out the corresponding truth table, which is great fun. So now you know the essence of how to do your computation and logic homework using Haskell. So that means you've really understood it. Now, we've got 5 minutes left. I've got one other thing to show you based on these ideas. But let's just check. Are there any questions about that? Yes. How do you work out precedence? That involves parsing, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. For the time being, what we're doing is we're always writing everything fully parenthesized. Right? When I wrote this formula here, I put in all the parentheses. I didn't leave any of them out. So that we don't need to worry about precedence because we're always putting in all the parentheses. But that's a good question. And then later, there's a whole technique about how do you convert strings into corresponding values, which is called parsing. And then you might say, oh, well, some of the parentheses are missing in the string. What do I do? So we'll talk about that later. Any other questions? Now, notice that if all you want to do with formulas is evaluate them, this is overkill. If all you want to do with formulas is evaluate them, you can do that already in Haskell. Right? You can just write and or normally as you would in Haskell. The reason we had to use constructors here was not for evaluating the formulas, but for things like finding out all the names in a formula. That's not something that you can do with an ordinary Haskell formula. What I wanted to show you is this technique that we used to find all possible environments is very useful, and you can use it in other ways. So for instance, somebody will turn off their phone. For instance, if you want to find all possible sublists in a list, right, just picking out any of the components, it's very similar. By the way, how many sublists are there for a list of length n? Well, each component in the list might either be present or absent. So again, for a list of length n, there are 2 to the n possible sublists.